Welcome to another UCTV.tv podcast presented by University of California Television.
It's tough right now. It's tough both in the state capitol and in Washington. Rarely have our leaders been as tested. And what I would like to do a little bit of as I go forward here is sort of give you a sense of what Congress was like when I first came to work in Washington in the mid-60s. Briefly, my congressman that I worked for had misjudged the Reagan Revolution, was still luxuriating in the LBJ sweep, and lost his office in 1966. Something that I kind of learned the hard way was never, ever be self-confident. Don't be overconfident. You know, be alert to the political challenges that are out ahead of you. I guess I hadn't learned that lesson. I wouldn't have been reelected in 1994 when I think I won with 48.4% of the vote. God bless the libertarian. So I'm here to tell you that the Congress was a different place, even in 1978 when Bob and I arrived. Certainly changed fundamentally in 1995 when Newt Gingrich led the successful Republican revolution. And it is today a very different place than it was then. And it's a really interesting, if you look at the sort of sociology of the Congress, and I'd like to do that with you a little bit. When I first came, Congress was mostly white, mostly male. The differences I think you could have almost analyzed as, well, there were Rotarians and there were Kiwanians, and there weren't very many Suroptimists. You know, they were not people who had fundamental differences, even though they had different parties. There was no Roe v. Wade and no deep cultural divide. Sure, there were people who represented urban and rural and suburban constituencies, but we were, at that time, much more likely to socialize across party lines. People would come to Washington for 6 months and return to their district for the other 6 months. Lindy Boggs, who was a great congresswoman from New Orleans, whose husband Hale had died in a plane crash in Alaska. You know Cokie Roberts from your NPR mornings. The daughter, Tom Boggs, one of the leading lawyer lobbyists in Washington. Lindy would talk about how they would socialize on weekends. You know, families would get together. You didn't demonize your partisan opponents because you knew them too well. They weren't people who were, you know, caricatured enemies, people you went up against. They were people you actually came to know and like. And that was changing even in the 70s when, you know, the Watergate class arrived with such great fanfare in 1974. Even then, given the bitter after effect of Watergate, there was still a good deal of camaraderie. More and more of it was perhaps developed on those terrible, politically toxic boondoggles travel overseas. It's never popular to travel, you know. You're always vulnerable to an attack piece in the election context. But, you know, it really was a place where members would get to know people who were from other parts of the country, who they had probably little in common with on the surface, but they had a common bonding experience. They spent a lot of time together in a very constrained environment. They were forced to get to know each other. And frankly, it fit in with the way in which the body functioned. We had people who were called bull weevils. Those were Southern Democrats, pretty conservative. Some of them more progressive on civil rights as time went on, but most of them pretty much traditionalist on those kinds of issues. They were economic conservatives. They were planters and bankers, you know. And they were Democrats because everybody was a Democrat, at least up through the 70s and 80s. And Republicans from the Northeast and from California, even. I think of Congressman Maillard from San Francisco, one of the last Republicans to represent it. I think Milton Marks might have been another one in the state legislature. But these were people who were socially pretty liberal, and often voted for things like anti-gun amendments. But they were Republicans, and they actually, in some ways, were balance wheels with these boll weevils, gypsy moths and boll weevils. Some people like that. You know, just kind of one insect for another. But they really did represent the diversity that the two parties at that point continued to have. And that's changed dramatically. It changed really with the passage of the Civil Rights Bill and gradually affected the people who were participating in politics in the South. We had more and more reapportionments that allowed African Americans to have districts. And normally it was done in concert with Republicans who ended up winning more of the rest that were white and conservative. Now that's begun to change back a little bit in the recent past, but it's still a phenomena through most of the time I was in Washington. And we saw most of the moderate suburban Republicans replaced with Democrats. So, you know, the parties became far more cohesive and far more focused on their own inner agenda. In fact, it coincided with the way in which life changed in Washington. No longer were you bringing your children to Washington and going home to the district with very little visits in between. More and more now, you were on the airplane, whether you went every weekend or every second or third weekend, probably was determined by whether or not you had a competitive district or not. You were probably on the cell phone and now the BlackBerry when you might have been conversing with someone on the House floor. You became more and more an individual political entrepreneur rather than a member of a party or a movement. You knew that if you were going to get reelected, you had to raise the money and do it yourself. The party would help, perhaps in that first opportunity to win a seat of the other party or win an open seat, but pretty much you had to learn to fend for yourself. You had to be an independent when it took that to satisfy your constituency, and a member of the party when it would only do you the most good. And so I think you saw a very significant change. One of the factors that I think people overlook, it's just not the jet airplanes and the cell phones, it's spousal employment. Increasingly, members of Congress, male and female, had spouses who worked. It was part of how you put kids through college and did all the things that the middle class was supposed to be able to do, actually the upper middle class, although most members of Congress never quite felt that way. In some districts, it was obvious you were, in many others, you weren't. But the bottom line was, you didn't pull up stakes from the district and move to Washington. Go Washington was a bad thing. Some people were talking to me yesterday about what brought Tom Daschle down in his last Senate race. And those ads of his great big house in Washington didn't do him any good at all. Because in South Dakota, he'd gone Washington. And so the Republicans played this very well in the aftermath of the Gingrich Revolution. Most of their members stayed in their districts. They shortened the work week to Tuesday to Thursday. People came in late, worked frantically, and went home. There wasn't any time to fraternize with the enemy, let alone make friends across the aisle. It added power to the leadership. You could herd people much more effectively when they weren't getting too smart, getting too informed. They needed to hear what the agenda was, and that's all they needed to know. Stick with the program. Democrats have never been quite that easily organized, but Republicans did sort of set the tone. That's how they won, by being focused and extremely partisan, willing to make a contrast with the leadership of the Democrats. And Democrats were all, in their view, alike, even though we know how diverse they were. But it was that model that Gingrich used to first win the majority and then to control the process until, like Robespierre, he went to the guillotine too and lost his speakership 4 years later. But it was that sort of approach to gaining power that, frankly, allowed the Democrats to take control not too long ago now, 3 years ago. Nancy Pelosi operates far more like the Newt Gingrich model than any of the Democratic speakers who preceded her, some of whom she's very close to and reveres greatly, because they were people who empowered the chairman. They gave power to the committees. There wasn't a great central authority, which really in some ways limited the ability of the Democrats to be a message party. Nancy learned from watching how first Gingrich and then Tom DeLay, a little bit of Dick Armey and Denny Hastert, had attempted to really bring the Republican Party to a point of most effectiveness. And it was unifying her troops, which she did so effectively, with an awful lot of love and a little bit of fear. Nancy governed effectively in the minority and brought back to power her party. But in winning the majority and then building on it, as she did in the last election with the Obama, I won't call it landslide, but overwhelming victory in some parts of the country, she was in a position to grow toward the center. And so as she's now got this tremendous responsibility of health care thrust upon her, she deals with a party that is from slightly right of center to very far left of center. And the task that she has on this health care bill that she hopes to bring to the floor this week and finish sometime next week, at least that was the agenda as of today, is a very difficult group to reconcile, to bring together. I think she will get her majority. I don't think she will get it by a very large percentage. But when the bill comes back from the Senate, whenever that is, could be in January now, because I think they'll spend the whole month of December on the Senate floor debating health care, then maybe a different mix of Democrats in the House can vote for it. But I do think she understands and her caucus understands, despite their widely varying views, that they have a must-pass piece of legislation. They analyzed their defeat in 1994 as the Democratic majority, in part based on their failure to pass health care. That failure distressed, deinflated the Democratic base. On top of that, instead of raising the corporate tax by maybe a quarter of a percentage, we raised the gas tax back in 94. And that gave the Republicans the chance to say we'd raise taxes on all Americans. And then we made a foolish decision to tie the assault weapon ban into the crime bill and get a bunch of people from conservative rural districts to vote for the rule that permitted the bill to come to the floor to be pillared by the NRA as having, you know, walked away from their long commitment to the Second Amendment. So Nancy's understood that she has to bring her party together, and the best way to do that is to find something that will hold the center of her party. There are progressives who refuse to vote for a health care bill that essentially doesn't have single payer in it, and certainly can't abide a watered-down version of a federal alternative. And there are conservatives in the party who are having a hard time just voting for the bill. And let's talk a little bit about health care in the context of that time in 94 and today. I think, first of all, I've talked about the committee chairs who guided the process. Tom Foley was a great guy, great speaker, but he let Chairman Rostenkowski of the Ways and Means Committee, Chairman Dingell of the Energy and Commerce Committee, essentially decide the fate of what was ultimately a tough failure to perform. We ended up with a very difficult scenario where we couldn't even bring a bill out of committee to help with the first phase of Clinton Care. It was a complete abject failure. Newt Gingrich showed us 2 years later exactly how to do it. You create a task force. Forget the chairman. You get the task force to put a bill together that was really the leadership's bill. You bring it to the Rules Committee and put it on the floor. What are you worried about these chairmen for? What are you really worried about how a committee may want to vote? If it's in the broader interests of the Republican conference, do it. Well, I think Democrats have come partway along in understanding that sometimes you have to find ways around the impediments that powerful individuals can sometimes put up that stands in the way of progress on behalf of the broader interests of the party. And so I look back now at the way in which we were organized, and I look at the way in which Nancy and Steny Hoyer, the majority leader, are functioning in the House, and I see a vast improvement. They have coordinated the efforts of three committee chairmen. They have amalgamated the bill into one, and it's on the floor. Took a while, but it wasn't a product of an IRA magaziner backroom sort of think tank that brought out a bill and slapped it on the desk where it was dead on arrival. It really was the product of a lot of tug and pull in the legislative process, which I think has been one of the weaknesses in some ways, but more importantly, a strength in that it does represent the will of the members of the caucus. And I say just the caucus because Republicans have been totally disinterested. I should have said at the beginning, you know, I try to be objective, and occasionally I show my partisan side. Republicans have taken on the Reagan mantle here, and I don't mean Ronald, I mean Nancy. Just say no. And it really has been their watchword on almost all of the major bills this session. Republicans are not really interested in seeing the Democrats succeed. And I have to say, the Democrats took the same approach when it was the Republicans who felt they had to pass a pharmaceutical benefit bill. They had to do it in the worst way, and they did. Remember, it was 3 hours when the roll was open on the House floor. And they passed it because they had to. They'd promised their base, the senior citizens continue to kind of lean Republican in this country. They certainly are the biggest opponent to health care progress this year on average. They don't want their Medicare cut, even though Republicans have been saying for years we have to reduce the cost of Medicare. This year they're running ads all over the country, not here because it doesn't do any good, but in most red states saying they're going to cut $500 billion out of your Medicare. And so the seniors tend to be opposed. We also have a difference in the media these days. In those days, we still had a lot of opinion-making editorial pages. We had a lot of in-depth coverage on health care. You really have to struggle now to find a Robert Pear at the New York Times or some of the others who cover health care in a knowledgeable way. I mean, there are a few in public broadcasting, but today it's very superficial. Most people get their information out of advocacy media, whether it's the left on the blogosphere or the right on talk radio and the right on Fox and the left on MSNBC. You know, we all go where we have to go to get people who tell us what we want to hear. And we even live in communities where we don't have to find too much difference of opinion with our neighbors. You know, we sort of self-select in this society. And so we are warring camps, lobbing rhetoric back and forth, and our political leaders who like to raise money online and in telemarketing play right into that. It's not conducive to getting compromise or getting consensus in the broader body. Right now, I think Democrats would be happy enough to have it within their own caucus. We had Harry and Louise, though. And today, television spots are still most important. Harry and Louise have shifted sides, by the way. They were a major problem last time, even though they didn't get a lot of exposure. It was the free media that picked it up. Remember, there's got to be a better way, they said, you know, which is to say, not this, something else, but not this, you know, but nobody ever gave them the alternative. There wasn't one. And there hasn't been one during the remaining 12 years of the Republican majority. Today, they will advocate giving everyone a tax credit to go out and buy a health insurance. Of course, forgetting about whether you have a prior condition or a chronic illness or what have you. There's really no alternative to whatever the Democrats can come up with other than no. And the media is playing into that. I mean, we had a summer not only of, you know, contentious town hall meetings that were chronicled on cable, but we had television ads pounding away on the cuts to Medicare. The death squads, remember? The people who were going to pronounce thumbs down on grandma. Nothing to it. In fact, a Republican senator from Georgia had wanted to make mandatory something that the Democrats said should be optional, and that was to reimburse a physician who responded to the request of a patient's family to discuss end-of-life procedures. That became, you know, they're out to kill grandma. We're going to take care of all the illegals. Well, illegals will get cared for, but not at federal expense. It will come out of the local taxpayers or the other insurance payers. But today, we all pay about $1,000 more on our family policy covering the uninsured. So this wasn't just about the moral imperative to be the last industrialized country in the world to cover everybody. It was an economic incentive, not just to try to reduce the overall cost of health insurance for all of us. It was also, really, frankly, to bend, as you've heard, the cost curve. How do we cut the cost of health care, which is blown through 20% of our national economy and continues to go forward, while we still have really pretty pathetic health care indices. If we look at the degree to which we take care of our people in this country less effectively than many of the other people who are nowhere near as affluent, but do a better job of getting care to all corners of their society. There's no question that the deficit, it makes things much more difficult today. Everything that the president proposed has to be looked at in the context of out-year expenditures. We all know in the short run, economists from one end of the spectrum to the other, that we really do need to be priming the pump and building on the supply side, getting the economy going again. At some point, and this is the debatable one, we need to begin to shut down on federal spending and bring our percent of GDP for national debt down to something in the historic range, maybe 1 to 2%. And this is not just a nice thing to do because it makes us feel better, although it does. Most Americans are hoarding cash and sitting on their money right now because they have the same need that the government does. Of course, that's a little bit detrimental to kicking the economy into gear, but it's a human instinct. And there is, just as there was in the Roosevelt era, a pressure on Congress to rein in spending, perhaps prematurely, perhaps counterproductively. But it certainly colors the debate on health care. And so there's a tremendous amount of pressure to raise the revenues and to cut the spending in the internals of this bill so that it, if it doesn't reduce the deficit, certainly won't expand it. And there is hope that there is some fundamental reform in this. It doesn't get a lot of discussion. But physician groups, which we know well in California, with capitated programs, cut health care costs. The Medicaid costs in California, Medi-Cal, are half what they are in New York State, because there they rely on fee-for-service. And here we often give that care in groups that drive down the cost. People at the Kaiser Permanente groups are aware of how that capitation has worked for those like me who've been in that program for some 40 years. So there is a lot of different economic environment in which we have to work this time around. There is one constant, though: employer mandate. Bill Clinton, Hillary, and the current administration have concluded that building on the existing system of employer coverage is the way to go. It's easy to say that, but it gets much more complicated. Do you mandate coverage? And if you have the refusal of the, say, small business entity to provide it, do you make them pay a fee? And how big should that fee be? If you are going to set up a federal alternative, does that suffice as a place for the small business or the sole practitioner to take their health care in order to get insurance that would be perhaps competitive with a large corporation could obtain for their broader workforce? Can you somehow blend in enough people in that form of employment that you can take the sting out of some very expensive health care requirements that can blow up the plan for a small business? Somebody's very sick, it just raises the rates on everybody. So a broader insurance exchange, which this bill contains, and a alternative that will be there for people who otherwise fall through the cracks. And then, of course, do we incentivize individuals to sign up for that? And if we don't incentivize them enough, will we still cover enough? Because even the best estimates are that we're still going to leave a certain percentage of people in this country uncovered, at least initially. So it's a very, very different bill than the bill that we attempted to pass and got very little traction with back in 1993. But in a fundamental way, it does continue to base the employer as the centerpiece of coverage in this country. What it really tries to do is to give employers, whether they're self-insured or whether they contract with health insurers, profit or nonprofit, an opportunity to improve the benefit package they offer, and hopefully at a declining cost going forward. Now, I did want to take questions, and I know a lot of you probably would love to participate. I hope you'll take me in some new directions, and I hope at the same time you will challenge perhaps some of the things I've said. You know, I don't even know it anymore when I shave the truth. I try not to, but occasionally it's just instinctive. So I guess what I would like is a little interaction with you on health care or on the Congress, the kind of people who are showing up there. It is a much more diverse institution, much more like America. And because America doesn't talk to each other very effectively, we ask our members of Congress to do it. And it's not all that easy for them either, because they come with all the biases that we have, all the prejudices, all the instincts, and occasionally those clash across the aisle, within the caucus in conference. So, you know, we, I think, sometimes denigrate our elected officials. There are those who fail us and those who really aren't up to the challenge. But it's amazing the number of people who rise to the occasion, who show courage, who are principled when you could find it so easy for them to give in to, you know, whatever the popular view of the moment is. And they come in all shapes and sizes these days. They are more and more reflective of the kind of community we have in California, let alone the country. And so I leave for a moment here with those thoughts, because while I don't look back with a desire to serve once again, I do look back with tremendous pride and satisfaction and real recognition and respect for the people that I serve with, by and large, and the people who have continued to come after. We have avoided what I believe is a plague in Washington, term limits. The average member only serves probably 6 to 8 years at best, and people only focus on the people like John Dingell who've been here 50 years. They don't understand a turnover is the norm, and there are an awful lot of new people coming in the door 50, 60, 70, almost every term. But the quality of people continues to be high. They are not all in sync on ideology, but increasingly really prepared in their life experience, it's no longer only lawyers need apply, to really represent the diversity of the country. So with that, I'd love to hear what's on your mind. Thank you very much.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.